the Mahayana Sutra discourse called the Lotus Sutra. And in it, there's a story of a son and his father. And this story, as many of the stories in the Lotus Sutra, are meant as similes, kind of teaching stories, parables. And in this story, the father is a very wealthy man, has a wealthy estate. And the son, when he's quite a young man, decides to venture forth into the world and make his own fortune, find his own way. And so he leaves home, he leaves his hometown, and he wanders around and runs into a lot of bad luck. And soon enough, he becomes destitute and becomes a beggar, wandering around with nothing. And people treat him as a beggar, and nameless beggar, and treat him a little bit like an outcast. And after a while, he kind of even forgets who he is. He forgets, you know, his name, and he forgets where he came from, and forgets lots. He doesn't really know who he is anymore. He's just this beggar. That's the way people treat him, and that's the way he sees himself. And he wanders around. After many years, he somehow coincidentally wanders back into his hometown, though he doesn't recognize it. And he happens to wander down the street where he grew up, but he doesn't recognize it. And he walks right by the estate where he grew up, doesn't recognize it. But his father, who's out in the gardens, recognizes this man as his son. But the father is a little bit wise, and he recognizes what's happened, that his son is, you know, down and out, and maybe a little bit lost, a little bit of his mind, or a little bit confused. And so he doesn't feel like he can rush out and, you know, say, "Hello, son." He just confused the poor man. So he runs after his son, and he says, "Oh, sir, you look like a strong man, and I need someone to shovel shit, manure, in my garden. And I wonder if that's something you could do for a few hours, and I'll give you a little bit of money or some food or something." And the young man says, "Oh, how lucky I am. You know, I can do something as simple as shovel manure. I'm probably, you know, that's about all I'm worthy of doing anyway." So he comes in and he shovels the manure, and when that's done, the father says, "That was really great. You did a really great job. How about if I give you a daily job every day? You come and do this for us." And the young man feels really lucky, and so he decides to come every day, and he has kind of a first time in a long time kind of steady job. And after a while, he does that, and the father says, "Oh, you're doing this really, really good. Why don't you join the gardening crew and become a gardener for me?" And he does that, and he learns the skill of gardening, and with time, he advances and becomes the head gardener of this big estate. And then after a while, the father says, "You know, you did really great as head gardener, and you're able to take care of the accounts really well, the gardening. I'd like you to invite you into our house now and maybe be my assistant accountant of my affairs." And he does that, and, you know, he feels slowly, bit by bit, he feels like he's worthy and capable of advancing. And after a while, he becomes a chief accountant. And after a while, you know, it feels like he's almost like the adopted son. You know, he's like so intimate with the family and so connected to everything. And only then does the father realize that the son is now ready to hear the truth. And he says, "Not only are you my adopted son, but you actually are my son. But if I told you that, you know, back there when you were shoveling manure, you simply wouldn't have believed it. It was so far from your experience. But you've always been my son, and it took this long for you to learn that was the case." So there's many things we can do with this teaching story, but one of them that's often done is that it points to the idea that we lose touch of who we really are, that somehow there's beauty, perfection, completeness in who we are innately, innate Buddha nature or something like that, and that in the course of wandering through samsara, we lose touch with our innate perfection, completeness, and part of spiritual practice is to rediscover that. And it's not so easy to do that, and sometimes we have to go through, you know, endless, you know, 10-day retreats before we finally kind of be whispered to you, "Oh, by the way," because, you know, you have to shovel a certain amount of manure before you're ready to hear that. So, and related to that kind of teaching is a teaching that you hear sometimes in various spiritual traditions, not just in aspects of Buddhism, that the present moment is complete and perfect just the way it is. And this kind of teaching appears frequently enough that if you've heard such things, or maybe sometimes people hear this, the first reaction, often the very sensible reaction, commonsensical reaction, is, this is absurd kind of teaching. There's nothing complete and perfect of my life. There's so many unresolved issues, so much suffering in my life, so much illness, so much struggle, so much oppression that I live under, that, you know, how can I possibly say that, you know, things are complete and perfect? You know, this is insulting to me in my situation. And so we come and we dismiss that kind of teaching. Or we hear other people who give this kind of teaching about how everything is perfect and complete just the way they are. And, you know, we say, well, that's fine for him, you know. He's a privileged, white, Protestant male. You know, he probably doesn't realize how good he has it. You know, I'm not one of those people, and society is really hard for me, and I'm not going to listen to that kind of teaching. Or some people say they have that experience. They say they actually, it's not just a teaching, but they have an actual direct experience of, maybe it's just fleeting, but of a moment or moments or a day of their life where they feel things are full and perfect, complete, just the way they are. Nothing else is needed, kind of feeling of being at peace. And it could be easy to dismiss that as being, oh, those people are just myopic. They don't really notice what's really going on in life. They're kind of living in denial. And if they had the life that I have, they would know differently. And but what happens when we have that experience for ourselves? What happens when we have feeling of, oh, this moment just now feels complete, perfect, nothing else is needed, nothing needs to be taken away. I can be at peace just right now. I'm at peace right now. Do you ever have moments like that? And do you give them any credence? Do you give them any importance, any value? Do you listen to them? Do you use them as teachers to help guide you in your life? It's very easy to have, maybe it isn't so easy to have these moments, but these moments sometimes come, or approximations of them can come, and it's very easy to dismiss them or to overlook them. We're so busy that last thing we have time to hear is some kind of teaching that says you don't have to be busy. Well, you know, we're kind of rushing ahead or wanting something to happen, or, you know, you're sitting after lunch, you know, having a tea and on the terrace down there, and things feel quite fine for a moment. And then suddenly the urge comes that, oh, I better get some exercise, I better get some more tea, or I better go back and get one more piece of tofu before it's all gone, or, you know, and suddenly, you know, those desires take precedence for us over that very simple, maybe seemingly insignificant moment of feeling well, having some sense of well-being. But sometimes these things happen more powerfully, stronger sense that kind of makes an impression on us. And a short while ago, I had one of these myself. And it was, I was sitting with a friend in her garden, kind of on her little, sitting around in little deck chairs or whatever, and we were sipping tea, and I was looking out into the garden, and there was a big redwood tree, and the beautiful streaming sunlight was kind of shining up this little grassy area. You see the light shining through, and there was all these hovering little insects, flies, kind of hovering around, and I was looking at this kind of timeless moment, feeling very peace and complete. This was all that was needed. Nothing else was needed. This moment was complete and perfect the way it was. Sound of traffic in the distance. Feeling of kind of timelessness and peace. So that was nice. But what made this that particular incident powerful for me was the context in which it occurred. Because the woman that I was visiting, the day before, I had helped her bury her only child. So I was visiting her, a mourning mother, just checking in with her and seeing how she was. And I was, you know, certainly I was filled with the strength of the feelings and emotion of visiting this mourning mother. And also for me, having just come back from the cemetery the day before and been there for the burial. And if you've been to Colma, some of the cemeteries in Colma, you see these great long vistas of gravestones. And it was very powerful to be there, as it often is, at a burial. And there was a kind of the various people spoke at the burial, and there was this, you know, poignancy about the loss that had just occurred, and the sense of, you know, many of the people, when you hear other people speak about someone who's passed away, there's sometimes a feeling you learn more about the person than you actually knew when you knew them. It fills in their picture, and they feel, you know, and you realize how much you've lost, or you feel a greater sense of that person, sometimes a greater sense of presence of that person. Certainly being at a cemetery like a coma, the power of, you know, all those gravestones and looking around and seeing all those people over the last 120 years or something that have been buried there. And you look at the dates and see all the various kinds of dates that are present, and you calculate how old those people lived. And there's a kind of very, very strong and very powerful. For me, it was very powerful to be there for the burial and to be there for the strength of the cemetery. And certainly it kind of made me kind of reflect, kind of in my gut, on the nature of death. But more importantly, or more powerfully for me, almost, what is it to be alive? What is it to be alive at this moment? I think for me, it's being there at the burial, this moment, this present lived moment, became very powerful and stood out for me in a way that sometimes only happens on retreats or in strong periods of meditation. I'm very fond of looking at old photographs. And many of you have heard this from me before. Old photographs, the older the better. You know, they should be 100 years old or something. And because what I like to do is, there should be a photograph of people. And I like to look at the pictures, the faces of the people, and look at the different expressions there. And it really strikes me, you know, you find all these different attitudes sometimes in those faces, sometimes of kind of anticipation and joy and happiness, sometimes sadness, sometimes exhaustion and weariness, disappointment. There's a whole range of things that are captured, and they've been captured now for 100 years in these photographs. And sometimes I'll see what appears to me in the eyes of the person photographed, a kind of a glimmer of consciousness or life, or like that moment of consciousness, moment of being alive, somehow I've been captured. And I feel like I'm looking into the eyes, the living eyes of someone who's been long dead. And it took me a while to realize why it is that I like these photographs. And how I understood it is now is that it makes me much more aware of this present lived moment for myself and how precious it is. You know, that they had their moments to be alive with. And their moments to be alive with just as valid as any other moments. And now I have mine. This is my moments to be alive and experience what consciousness is and experience what life is. And I value that. I find that it kind of makes my life seemingly more precious in the context. So kind of similar to this was yesterday morning, before coming here, I spent some time visiting a friend of mine who had died. He just died. So I visited him in his deathbed, and we had did a little ritual, and I just spent a lot of time just sitting with him, being with him, talking to him some, and being with this somewhat or completely inanimate being, object now at this point. And I came from there almost filled with that here last night to the retreat. And I sat here looking at all of you and seeing kind of hovering above you all his face, his dead face, and the contrast between each of you and your life, your livingness, how you're alive right now, and the preciousness of that, and my sense of appreciation and awe and at the mystery and preciousness and whatever of just, you know, every gesture and movement and expression of life that's being expressed here. I'd had no sense, you know, in that kind of contrast. Every possible gesture and movement seemed really precious to me and powerful and wonderful. And then I was sitting here when we did a little meditation, and part of my body was kind of uncomfortable. But my friend was still very present for me, and I said, oh, this discomfort is proof that I'm still alive. And it was a lot easier to be with it. So, oh, this is interesting. This is life. This is what it is to be alive. So I was sitting there in her garden, having these moments of completeness. Now, is it appropriate in the context that I was sitting in, visiting a woman who had just lost her only child, myself filled with the sense of feeling of sadness and loss that I carried with me from the day before. Is it ethical for me to sit there and feel that the present moment is complete and perfect just the way it is in that context? Well, let me give you a little bit more of the context. This feeling of being complete and perfect just the moment, just the way it was, it wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't exactly manufactured, but it wasn't spontaneous. In fact, what had happened was I'd been there for a while with her, and the impulse to get to leave and get on with my day and take care of all the important things I had to do arose for me. And I actually started feeling a little bit impatient, a little bit eager to get on with life, to get on with things. And I recognized that. I recognized that impulse as it arose. And I think a lot of what spiritual practice is like, or what's about Buddhist practice, is recognizing those impulses within us that want us to take us away, or want to push something away, want things to be different than what they are, or want to hold on to things, tightly. This is the way it has to be. There's so many reactive ways in which we live our lives that a lot of what we learn to do is to simplify ourselves and learn not to live in those reactions, not to live in the impulses. It reminds me of when I was a young man, a college student. I used to go to parties. And after a while, I recognized a personal trait which was rather uncomfortable for me and embarrassing to report to a great, big group like this. It was that no matter who I was talking to at the party, I always thought there was someone else I should be talking to. Someone else who was better to talk to, more important to talk to, more whatever, I don't know exactly. But it was always, I was never satisfied with the person I was with. And sometimes I thought I knew who the person was I was supposed to be talking with. And I'd go and talk to that person, and then I felt I was being left out of some other thing that was important that was going on. That impulse, these bizarre impulses we have, that don't allow us to just be present and settled with things as they are. So I recognized that it was happening when I was sitting there with her. And I was helped in an odd way because I remembered what I was about to go off to do. And the day was dedicated for me was to doing a self-retreat, to go and sitting there and being fully present for the present moment just the way it was without trying to make it be any different. So the absurdity of, running away from this present moment so I can get to a different present moment where I could do it, became clear to me. And so I was helped then by all that, and so I very quickly then let go of that impulse, those impulses that arose, and as the impulses disappeared, then I found myself just sitting there, this feeling of peace and contentment and feeling of completeness of the moment. The completeness of the moment, of course, included the weight of what the meeting was about and the weight of the funeral the day before and the death. It included my sadness. So to feel complete or feel at peace or to be at ease in the present moment with the present moment as it is, doesn't have to look like some great exalted spiritual state where there's no sadness and no pain and no personal whatever problems, which is often a mistake that many of us make. We think, if only, so I talked about last night, if only I'm able to overcome this resentment or this pain or this personal hang-up, this suffering that I carry with me from childhood or whatever, then, I have some possibility of being at ease or at peace. But my suggestion is that you don't necessarily have to step out of these things, but rather is it possible to let go of the impulses and reactions that judge them and push them away, and we're trying to that fuel kind of forward thinking and forward making and constructions of identity and all the things we do. Let go of all the impulses, and the problems don't necessarily go away, the sadness, the pain, But there can be a sense of peace or an ease in the midst of that anyway. So how is it here on, you know, the first day of a retreat? You know, maybe many of you haven't felt any sense of completeness and ease and peace. And, you know, I think this is a ridiculous talk to give the first evening of the retreat. You know, you're probably thinking, you know, it's probably better talk to give the last day, you know. And your only reason you're putting up with all this is because you heard that later on things get better. Or you've been in a few retreats before where, in fact, later on did feel better and you felt something like this. You felt some completeness later. So you're bargaining, you know, I'll put up with this now for future well-being and happiness. And or this is your first retreat and you don't know that things generally get better. And so you just think it's going to be downhill from here on out. And this is, you know, an absurd thing to do with your life. Absolutely absurd. You know, the Santa Cruz beaches are pretty close by. And you know, and there it's, you know, it's fine to be complete there. There was a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where Calvin is climbing a tree, Hobbes is following, and Calvin says, oh, to be in the present moment is so wonderful and perfect, and this is, you know, how everybody should live their lives. And Hobbes says, well, but you're actually supposed to be in school right now. Well, some present moments don't cut it. But I wonder how much of the suffering that occurs the first day of the retreat is not because of the first day of the retreat and the difficulties, the tiredness, the achiness and all that, but really has to do with the impulses inside of you, the judgments, the ideas of what's supposed to happen, what you're supposed to be look like, you know, what progress is supposed to be look like. You know, it's the fifth minute into the first sitting of the first day and I'm still having attained samadhi, one point of concentration, and then now it's the sixth minute and I still haven't attained it, shoot. Well, I've heard that it's not good to measure all that quickly, so I'll wait 2 more minutes before I measure how well I'm doing. And it just becomes kind of self-defeating to be measuring ourselves and checking in with ourselves, how am I doing against some kind of standard? Or waiting for something to happen that's going to be different, bargaining with the present moment, holding on to fleeting moments of well-being that might be there, or indulging in the good food because, by God, it's been a hard enough day, I deserve some pleasure. What are all the impulses of suffering that arise in the course of a day like today? And how much of them have to do with being in trying circumstances of the first day, and how much of them have to do with being, you know, in reaction to how things actually are? So the need to prove ourselves to others, the need to, the concern about what other people are thinking about us, the concern about how other people feel about us, the concern about who we've been in the past and the things we've done in the past, the concerns about what's going to happen to us in the future, can be impulses that take us away from ourselves. As I was sitting with my friend, visiting her in her sadness, it would have been very easy for me to have been caught up, maybe earlier in my life I would have been caught up in great worry about what's the right thing to say here. Am I counseling a mourning mother right? And, you know, I'm responsible here somehow for her well-being and her happiness, and I'm not saying the right things, and I'm sitting here quietly looking at the flies in the garden, and this is, you know, shouldn't happen. And it would have been very self-conscious about my performance, in a sense, in relationship to what I was doing there. And luckily, I didn't have any concern about my performance. I knew that my intention was to be present for her and offer the best presence I could and offer whatever I could to be helpful. And that intention was taking its course and it was unfolding the way it did, and unfolded in a very nice way for both of us, I think, into a period of silence, just looking in the garden. So how does our self-consciousness get in the way? How simple can we become? How thoroughly can we leave ourselves alone? So I label that experience in the garden a sense of completeness. And that's not really very accurate. And if you don't like that word, feeling things are perfect and complete just the way they are, sometimes I share that sentiment, that it's not language that's so comfortable, maybe even very accurate. Because it's assigning a value or a description on what's actually there. What was important was not the label of feeling complete, of being complete or perfect. What was important was that process of letting go. Letting go of the impulses, the attachments, the fears, the anxieties, self-consciousness. That was what was important. And what happened? What is left when you do that? What is left when you simply let go of all the extra reactions and impulses? And there's one strong strand of Buddhism which doesn't want to tell you what's left. It says that it's very important to let go and come to that place, but it's not going to tell you what it is. In fact, if you think it's complete, you have to let go of that sense of completeness too. It's not important what it is once you've let go of all your suffering. You can be content then. The desire to know and to label and to hold on to what it actually is often another movement towards suffering. Have I arrived there yet? Have I got it yet? Am I one of those kinds of people yet? I must be one of those people. I hope the teachers have noticed. Or not noticed because I'm one of those wrong kind of people or whatever. It's not a matter of being anything or attaining anything or getting some state. And that's very hard sometimes to appreciate, to have trust in, because we really want to have something positive for security reasons or for just whatever, that we think this is it. But there's a very strong strand, lineage in Buddhism, that doesn't want to say what it is. What it is can be whatever it wants to be, thank you. It doesn't need to be defined or held on to or even understood. What needs to be understood is the impulses, the reactions, the attachments, the greed, the clinging, the fears, the inhibitions that operate within us. And then learning to let them go. Or if you can't let them go, learning to see them in a wider context. Learning to see them in a more generous way, in a kinder, more compassionate way. So, you know, to go to the kalma and see all those different gravestones and to see, you know, or to imagine looking at all of them, how much of our human experience we have in common with each other. So much, there's a wide range, of course, but so much of being born, of experiences of living, people die around us, and we die and we get sick, and all those people in underneath those gravestones experience much of that also. Sometimes much more miserable, much difficult life than ours, sometimes easier perhaps, but in a wide range of our common humanity. And I find it a little bit helpful to appreciate the common humanity of my problems, my difficulties, and my attachments and my neuroses and the ways my mind works in odd and funny way. Because then when I see it, I can treat it in a lighter way, more open, more generous, more compassionate. Self-compassion is an underappreciated resource, endangered resource that we all need to kind of preserve, to have compassion for ourselves, for what's there. Not to think, oh, I can't let go of this so easily, so I failed. Nothing needs to be different except how we appreciate it, how we hold it. So one of the kind of unfortunate things about Dharma practice is that wisdom and freedom, to a great extent, comes through familiarity. And familiarity means you have to see something really well, sometimes over and over and over again. And that's bad news, right? I mean, self-knowledge is often bad news. you know, we see all our different tendencies of the way our mind works, how we get cling and get attached, and we create a sense of self and suffer because of it. Don't despair at seeing these things. Appreciate the value of seeing these things so you can see the other side. So you can see the possibility of relaxing, letting go of it. So you can see the possibility of holding it with compassion. Suffering is present when those things are there. To hold it with care and tenderness, in the way that a mother would hold, protect her only child, as it says in the Metta Sutta. So you will see all kinds of ways in which your mind, funny ways in which your mind works. You sit here. That's part of the path. And if you recognize it as part of the path, then it can be a lot easier. Because then you're less likely to fight against yourself because these things are there. I think that it shouldn't be this way. This is the moment of life for you now. I like very much that, I'll say it this way. I have a sense when I'm on retreat that part of what I'm doing is I'm along for the ride. Part of what I'm doing is trying to bring as much clarity and mindfulness, discovery of what's happening at the present moment as I can. What's actually happening right now? Right now. The basic question for Vipassana students is, what's happening right now? And if you can ask that question clearly enough, if you can ask that question with enough clear observation, we tend not to be entangled with what we're looking at. And that disentanglement is a moment of moving towards freedom, of seeing kind of everything in a bigger context. As we begin to leave ourselves alone, our inner life, our psychic life, participates, shares with that, supports that. Because as I said last night, there's a great gravitational pull within us towards greater and greater simplicity and freedom. The impulses that take us away from the present moment are working against gravity. And if we begin simplifying ourselves to some degree, then we begin going, allowing gravity to do its work. And the psychic gravity will carry you to becoming simpler, easier, with a few bumps along the road. It's what I think your heart's innermost request is to have that simplicity. The path to it is to allow and accept with great awareness what is actually happening for you right now. No need to think it needs to be any different. And so the Lotus Sutra, this great Mahayana discourse, has another simile, and that's the simile of the man, kind of similar kind of story, I guess, of a man who goes out drinking with his buddies, and he becomes kind of falls asleep completely drunk, and he's kind of a homeless kind of person, and someone comes along and sews a huge jewel, big diamond, inside his coat while he's sleeping. And then when he wakes up, he gets up and continues his wanderings around begging and drinking and hoping someday maybe he can get his life better and maybe make a little bit of money and settle down and not suffer so much. And he simply doesn't know that inside his coat there's this wonderfully precious jewel that's there. So in each of you, no matter what your suffering is or how strong it is or how difficult it is, each of you has a jewel. Each of you is a jewel. Even in the midst of your suffering, there's a jewel in your suffering. Your suffering doesn't have to be an excuse for why you can't do it. So I hope that you appreciate the jewel in which you are. And I hope that in this course of these days in the retreat, that you remind yourself often to treat yourself with compassion and loving kindness. This talk today is not meant to suggest in any kind of way that what I've said today is easy. But it's a possibility for all of us. So may we all find our way home to what's always here. And those are my thoughts for today. Thank you.